You guys didn't see the action going on over here in the peanut gallery when I was introduced. My name's Gary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gary.
And I'm glad to be here. I'm always glad to come to Cincinnati. In 1977, right after we had moved here, just quick comment. That's a long way for these. I hope you're hearing me all right. You're not. Which one do I move? That one? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They had this one way down here for Colleen. It's a good thing they could hear you. They sure as hell couldn't see you. It was. Julie and I had just moved to Indianapolis from Denver, and we were so very lonesome. They just didn't do anything right in Indianapolis, and I was invited to speak at the first anniversary of the Cincinnati Young People's Group. And I spoke out in Marymount, some old hotel, on New Year's Day night of 1978. And we were received so warmly, and they were the kind of lunatics that we were used to from Colorado. And so there's always been a warm spot in my heart for Cincinnati. And there's some friends here, and I'm always glad to see them. So thank you very much for inviting me, whoever is responsible, I guess Tony. I was thinking earlier, it's nice they got the high bottom drunks out of the road ahead of me. I mean, yeah. Clara and Don. I mean, I learned a lesson watching Clara, though. I don't dare introduce my spouse as my Alana. She'll wring my neck. In fact, she doesn't like me to introduce her at these things anyway. She doesn't like it also. Clara, if you just stand up and point to her so everybody would know who she is. Thank you, yeah, thank you. She gave instructions to two or three of the guys here in the front row that if I tell a lie, they're to pick her nose or something so she can recognize it and do something about it. I was speaking the other night at a meeting there in Indianapolis. It's one of those that meets out in one of the union halls. And you got all these guys in the blue shirts unbuttoned down to about here, hunkered over a cup of coffee and a cigarette, looking at you saying, I dare you to say something to help me. And I was telling Bob I was a lot more nervous speaking at a group in my hometown than these things make me, but I'm not so sure that's true right now. I think something changed. I found my way into AA by way of a nut house in Evanston, Wyoming. My dry day's the third day of December, 1964, and the only reason I tell you that's because I'm bragging. That was the day that I found myself in this nut house. I had got there as a result of becoming everything I despised. There was virtually nothing about me worth having. Not a thing. I couldn't have pointed to an asset I had other than I was still breathing in and out, and that was a miracle. That had nothing to do with me. I had hit that nut house dying. Of course, I didn't know that. I was 6'2" tall, and I weighed something less than 130 pounds. That's real skinny. You walk fast, your legs whistle. And when I hit the door to that place, all I really knew is what I told you. I just despised everything about me. I didn't have any clue that I was as close to death that I was. And I really wasn't terribly sure what was wrong with me. I had been told by a lot of people that I drank funny and that I didn't do it the way I was supposed to. I didn't drink long. I drank alcoholically probably from the time I was 17 till I was 24 years old. And I hit that nut house a month before my 25th birthday. And like I say, I was dying by the time I had got there. I'm one of those that Burns was talking about. The first time I got a hold of enough, something changed. And I can kind of tell you about that. I was one of those that just never belonged, never fit. As a kid in school, I would sit at the back of the room and I just couldn't stand any attention being drawn to me. I just hated that. It was just horrible. I couldn't talk to anybody as a child, and then as a young teenager I couldn't, and I still couldn't even shortly after I got sober. I couldn't look you in the eye and carry on a conversation. It was too terrifying for me. Don one time years ago said he felt like he had a wart in the end of his nose, a great big one. Y'all couldn't see it, but it was there, and I stole that line, said, and I'm a little ashamed of myself for giving him credit for it right now, but that really fit how I felt, how out of place that I was. And so as a sophomore in high school, it was a point of time in my life where a lot of things were changing for me, and I knew I was supposed to do some things differently. I really thought it had been a good idea to talk to girls, but I couldn't pull it off. I couldn't do it. And it was really crazy. Two other fellows and myself drove over to Laramie, Wyoming to the state basketball tournament this one day. I guess I was a sophomore in high school. And we got a hold of some fellas to buy us some booze, and so we got a hold of a quart of Four Roses and some Coca-Cola. You got to explain it. We picked up a couple of girls, that those guys did, and we took off for the boondocks, the 9th Street Hill, it's called there. I got to thinking about long after I got sober, I got to remembering this one particular night. We had the booze in the car and we had the girls in the car and we're heading for the boondocks and we didn't know what to do with either one. Yeah. Yeah. You couldn't go down to the drugstore and buy the magazines that explained it all like you can now. We got out there and we passed the jug around. And the first time it went around, I did it just like I'd watched the Cowboys do it out there, you know. They wipe it off for some damn reason and take a hit, pass it on. And the second time it came around, I tipped it up and I kept it up there until they took it away from me. And I got a hold of a bunch of whiskey real quick. And what happened to me, you know, Burns explained it exactly that night. I no longer felt like I didn't belong with that group in that car. Hell, I felt like I owned that group in that car. And it was great, you know. I could speak to everybody in there. I could carry on a conversation. And one of the girls had a couple of points about her that just fascinated the hell out of me. And I made a clumsy grab for her, and she liked to beat me to death. A little while later, they're going to sober me up, so they took me to the Diamond Horseshoe truck stop and gave me some coffee, and that woke me up. And I took a poke at a cowboy, and he damn near did beat me to death. And that's the story of my social drinking. I could damn near sit down right now. I did more of that same stuff for 6 years, you know. It's a little crude way to put it, but my only goal in life when I went out at night was to get drunk, get in a fight, or get laid, not necessarily in that order. And generally, the first two always precluded the third anyway. And that was it. I don't understand social drinking. I don't know why. Every once in a while, I'll give Julie a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream for Christmas. Yeah. And about July or August, I throw the sumbitch away. You know, there's something seriously haywire about that. At any rate, the other thing I did that night, or the next morning, after I'd done all that and the guys were laughing at me and that, is I had to tell them some lies to explain away my behavior from the night before. Now, I didn't have to have that whiskey to learn to lie. I learned that when I learned to talk. But whiskey helped. I got better. I love the alcoholic in our lives. I just love to watch that. And I would tell you a story. I needed to be a part of your group so bad that I would just reach out in left field and grab on some story and lay it on you. You know, even if I didn't need to, I needed to stay in practice. You know, I might really need one someday. I just did that, and it's so fun. I love talking about it in a new meeting where there's some new guys there and the wife's with them. They get a little squirmy. They may catch an elbow in the ribs. It's great. But God, it was awful. It didn't quit just because I got sober. Well, 4 or 5 years sober, I got caught in the middle of a lie, some people that knew me pretty well and I had a lot of respect for. And I was terribly embarrassed about that. And it was probably one of those things that helped me to go on with the treatment for alcoholism. I'll share a little bit of that with you in a minute. In any event, I hit the nut house. At that point, Julie and I had been married for a while. We had three daughters. I had gotten a free bus ride to the nut house. It's about 400 miles. I tried to get Julie's dad to take me. I didn't think that was much of an imposition, but all he said, no, I'll buy you a bus ticket, though. And several years later, after he took me to the bus station, he told me that night when he took me down there, he hadn't much cared which bus I got on, just as long as it was leaving Cheyenne. And but I got to this nut house, and I learned some things there. I in fact learned that I was an alcoholic by looking at the Jelinek chart, the U-shaped chart that Burns talked about last night. And I guess I didn't realize that it was a 7-year progression down that chart. But I don't know if Don or Mike saw me last night. I was trying to figure that out. 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. Yeah. It's right there. It worked just fine. By the time I'm 24 years old, I'm as bad as you can get. I'm damn near dead. And what I learned in there was that I was an alcoholic, and I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I also knew that I was at least 15, 20 years younger than anybody else in that nut house on the alky ward with me. And in fact, I just remembered this the other day. They had to observe me a little while longer than they did some of the other alcoholics there, alky-holics. I was a little bit antisocial, and they kept me in this room, and they dried me out with some of the same stuff that Don was talking about last night, and the most thing I remember about that is how bad it smelled. Peraldehyde stinks, and it stinks for several days afterwards. It's probably a godsend they don't use it anymore. But I was sent to the alky ward, and somewhere in there this psychiatrist came down and talked to me. And he asked me some questions, and of course I'm terrified, and I'm doing my best to get him straight answers. And then he said to me, well, how does it feel to know that you have to go for the rest of your entire life and never take another drink? And I had just been thinking, looking at these other guys on the ward, that wouldn't be too bad if I was as old as they are. Their life's mostly shot in the butt anyway, and it wouldn't be now. And of course, I had a little more to learn. I found AA there. AA at the Wyoming State Hospital in 1964 was a program of attraction. And what that means is when they came and got you to take you to the AA meeting, if you didn't go, you got to change wards. And the other ward had smaller rooms and metal doors, and so you went. And I went in this room and I sat with these people and I was as afraid of them and I couldn't look them in the eye and talk to them. And I didn't know anybody that lived like that. I didn't know a soul that lived like that. They talked about God and prayer. Reminded me of the Mormons that lived next door, Claire and Carly. I don't know if I ever told you about that. Living in Wyoming, you had the droughts, and they'd get terribly bad, and my dad was such an unbeliever, sort of, that it would get too bad, and the wells would be drying up, and it'd get to be rough, and he'd run over to the Mormons and ask them to pray for rain. Sometimes it rained. That was as close to religion as I got, incidentally. That was it. I learned the Lord's Prayer in AA meetings. I don't know how many have done that. I learned it before we held hands to pray, fortunately, but you still don't want anybody to know that you don't know the Lord's Prayer. So you fake it. You get the Our Father down real quick, but then you got to mumble the rest quietly enough that they don't realize that you don't know it. Went to those AA meetings, and these guys would come in there, and I'd look out the window at their cars, and they couldn't have been drunks. Most of them cars had chrome strips on both sides of the car. They talked about going to AA meetings and not drinking for the rest of their lives, and I really didn't want anything to do with it, but I knew I had to. I was powerless over alcohol, and I was dying, and I knew it. And I got that part down real good. I sat in a conversation one day where there was maybe six or seven of us drunks down the canteen drinking coffee, sitting around a big round table telling lies. And the conversation got to be, well, what are we going to do when we get out of here? What's going to happen? And so some of the guys were talking about trying to go back to the ranch and help it out, and other fellows were heading back out in the oil patch. And they were all going to try to recover everything they lost, and it struck me. Two things struck me, as a matter of fact. In fact, first thing that hit me is I was sitting in a room full of has-beens, and I was a never-was. But it got to be my turn to talk, and I heard myself say, I don't have a clue what I'm going to do when I get out of here. All I do know is I never want to take another drink. And I phrase it that way because I've never had that thought up until that point in my life. I'd never thought about not drinking, really. Again, the idea of not drinking is just, I couldn't handle it. And so I qualified to be a member of AA that day. I met the requirement of the third tradition. Of course, I didn't know that then either. I didn't know a hell of a lot then, now to think about it. I left that nut house after 16 weeks. I had my health back. In fact, hell, I gained enough weight in that nut house. I thought I was ready to try out for the Broncos. I had never been that big, and I was feeling pretty good about myself until they put me on the bus to go back to Cheyenne. An interesting thing happened there. On the bus ride home, I found myself just as terrified, and I had that exact same feeling in me I'd had at any time in my drinking, and I think maybe it was worse, because I didn't have any insulation with me. It didn't work. I had that hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it, and I didn't have what used to fix it. The booze had quit fixing it a long time before that, but God, it was horrible. They'd come up to me in college, in that nut house, and they said, Gary, you know, when you leave here, you could go to college if you wanted to. In fact, there's an outfit out here that'll buy your books and tuition, and we'll pay you enough money to maintain your wife and children if you would like to do that. Well, my alternative to that was looking for a job. What would you have done, Bob? I mean, yeah. So we went to college, and that was a laugh. I did 4 years of college in three. I stayed terrified and the whole time I was at the University of Wyoming. I went to AA meetings there, and just very briefly, I don't remember much about them. Most of the people there were older than I, except for one other fellow. And we'd sit in those meetings, and we heard some of the strangest stuff I've ever heard in AA meetings. And lately, you can hear some really strange stuff in AA meetings. But they were sitting there, and the two conversations I remember the most is one elderly lady talked about going to AA meetings were the same thing as paying the premiums on her life insurance. And that didn't compute. Of course, I'd never owned any life insurance at that point. It still didn't make a lot of sense. And the other old boy was named Frank, and Frank had been in and out of AA many, many times for a long time, and he sat right there, and he says, I think the answer's in the third step. He says, I've done this for a long time, and he said, this last time I came in, I did the third step. I went and said that third step prayer. And that was on a Monday night, and Saturday night, old Frank came down drunk, and I didn't want any more to do the third step. And that's about all I remember. I was in AA in that small town, and nobody in that whole 3 years plus I was there mentioned reading the big book, much less reading the big book and doing what it says. It never happened. And so I got through my first nearly 4 year sobriety suffering from untreated alcoholism. There wasn't a morning I woke up that I wasn't terrified, that I didn't have the hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it. There wasn't a day I could carry on a conversation and look somebody in the eye. And somehow I finished school that way. And I ended up in Denver, and I ended up with the Denver Young People's Group quite by accident. I met Don there. Don and I have been doing this 25, 26 years. In fact, we did our first one together, now that I think about it. They made me the chairman at a Colorado State Convention in whatever it was, 70-something, two, three. And we had Don speak, and he got up there and he said something, and the crowd laughed, and he's been hooked ever since. At the Young People's Group at that point in time in Denver held two meetings a week. They had a big meeting on Sundays down at the club. There was an open speaker meeting, and it was one of the most popular meetings in Denver for years. It was a long time. A lot of the old timers around AA used to come down there on Sundays just to watch us. Because we were as outrageous then as Young People's is now, probably. We thought we were the first, which I guess now that I think about it, we might have been the first to have the real long, greasy hair and the smelly armpits and the earrings and the free love and flower children. And it was crazy. Talk about the group of people that normally would not mix. We had young professionals from downtown that would come to that meeting, and we had the flower children. One of the guys used to come to the meeting and stayed sober as a cashier in a porno shop. To this day, I don't know how he stayed sober, but he did. But we decided to start another group. In fact, we decided to study the big book together. And we didn't have a place to meet. The two places we held the other meetings weren't available to us, and so we decided to meet in homes. And to travel around. And we went and we opened the big book to the very first page. Isn't that ridiculous? And started the big book at the beginning. We didn't have any rules. None of us really knew what the hell we were doing. We'd heard some people in Canada did this, but we didn't know much about it. And we'd read maybe a paragraph or a page, and somebody was free to interrupt. In fact, I interrupted a few times. Somebody had read something in the book, and I interrupted, and I said, well, the way I interpret that, and a little guy with a smart mouth named Elise says, Gary, we don't much care. That's not a precise quote. He said it with him. And they told me they were interested in the black print on the white page. And I heard that a lot. Heard that a lot. And we would go on, and we just kind of did that. And we got into the book, and we would share what was happening. Now, the reason I'm kind of wanted to talk about this today is up until that time, hell, I'm nearly 4 years sober, and I had tried to read this big book any number of times by myself, and I couldn't get it done. I couldn't do it. I could read it, put it down, didn't have a slightest idea what I'd read. And here's Brady up there talking about attention deficit disorder. Yeah. We started in the group, and I could read it. If we would talk about it while I was reading it, and I could apply what it was talking about and relate to it, it made all the difference in the world than me just trying to read it and understand it. So anyway, we're going along. We get into the third chapter, more about alcoholism, your first step in the big book, if you will. In the first paragraph in there, or the first page of the third chapter, there's a paragraph there that says, we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step to recovery. The delusion we're anything like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. And the evening we read that, I was given the keys to the kingdom. And I really was. Because I had struggled for that point in time for about 4 years in AA, and all I knew, I was powerless over alcohol, whether I'm drinking it or you're drinking. I really understood that. I really understood that left to my own devices, I'll drink. And I really understood that at damn near 4 years, I was still sober, and I knew it was a miracle. I knew it was a gift, because if I did it my way, I'd drink. And I know that just as well today. And so all of a sudden, when I read that day, the first step in its entirety made a great deal more sense. You know, it goes on to say that our lives had become unmanageable, and I looked at that, and I've never been able to manage my life. I never have. Remember when I was a child, I was too afraid to talk to you, and I couldn't manage that. I couldn't make that happen. I couldn't manage any part of that. If I was afraid, I couldn't manage unafraid. If I was broke, I couldn't manage money. If I was on and on and on. If I was sad, I couldn't manage happy. And it didn't work. And all that was because I had the delusion I had to do that like other people. And I didn't have to do that anymore, and the pressure was off. And the first step since that point in time has never been a problem to me. I still understand that left to my own devices, I'll drink. And there might be a flip side to that statement. And that is, if I work these steps good enough and I really get going and I can get a spiritual life going, left to my own devices, if I'm in God's hands, I can't drink. Think about it. We went on to read, and we got into the fourth chapter more about alcoholism, and that's where I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I understood that the term sanity in the second step refers primarily to alcoholic insanity, which of course is the inability to stay away from the first drink. I really understood that. I think it means a little more than that. I think it means that we're going to be restored to some kind of wholeness. But I don't know what to be restored from. You know, I don't ever relate to that. And so certainly there's more to that. And I watched it happen in AA. I mean, Don and I watched some really sick pups come into this outfit, and they got well. In my case, they grew right past me, some of them. I'm absolutely serious. I mean that. These guys would come in and they could shake your hand, look you in the eye. And they could hold a job sober. I couldn't do that sober. Hell, I was still out there intentionally writing bad checks. Couldn't stand to be home on a Sunday with Julie and the kids because I just went crazy. I just went nuts. And these people were coming in and something had changed in their lives and they were getting well. And it must be a God. That changes a little while later to what better be a God. But there must be a God. I just would watch it happen. Because guys came in that had tried everything man has contrived to get sober and stay sober, and none of it worked, and I watched them. I knew a lot of them very well. You know, I watched old Jim come in, and he got saved 42, 43 times and never got sober. Tom came to us. Tom was 24, 25 when he came in there. And one of the ways he had tried is he'd gone into Mount Airy. Isn't that a great name for a nut house? Mount Airy for the airheads. And the treatment for him was the old diversion treatment. And he explained that to us and what it was, but it was just a hospital setting and had one treatment room that was a fairly good sized room. Had mirrors on the walls and shelves attached to all the mirrors, and on the shelves were all different kinds of liquor. In the middle of the room is a barber chair with a stainless steel pot attached to one arm on the chair that would swivel in front of or away from whoever's sitting in the chair. And they'd given Tom some Anabuse, and they said he could have anything he wanted to drink. Of course, the whole idea of this now is you drink it, you get sick because of the Anabuse, you get violently ill, your hair falls out, you watch yourself throw up, your teeth come loose, your toenails curl, and you're just going to be so adverse to this whole deal, you're just never going to ever take another drink. And when Tom came to us, he said, Gary, it worked. He said it really did. He said he's not had reason or excuse to take Anabuse since. And he didn't. We read on. We took the third step prayer together. And the reason we did it was because little Lee says, I got an idea. He says, I think we all ought to open our books and read / pray this third step prayer together. He said, the reason I want to do that is I'm nearly 4 years sober, and every time I go to an AA meeting, and if I ask people the question where they are in the steps, most of them say, I'm at the third step. And if I ask them why they've never written an inventory, they'll say it's because I've never taken a third step. And he says, so that scares me a little bit. He says, I'll ask people that go out and drink how far they got in the steps before they drank. Of course, we know differently, but they'd say they thought they'd gotten to the third step. So he says, I want to do this together. If we'll all stand up, hold hands, read / pray the third step prayer together, then if a couple weeks from now I tell anybody that I haven't written an inventory because I've not taken the third step yet, you can call me a damn liar because you saw me do it. And that's why we did it. And we got through the third step that night. Now, I don't know how important that is to you folks. I really don't. There was about 14 of us there, as near as we can recall. And 13 of us are still alive and still sober in AA. This took place back in the early 1970s. Most of us are out and around. We're doing stuff like this. We're helping people through the steps. We're talking at meetings. And we're doing it. The one we lost went out and died an alcoholic death. And he may be the very reason that the 13 of us are still here. Because Eddie drank and went out and froze to death. And it got our attention. But that's important. I defy you to go out and find 13 people that were gathered together at one time at any point in A and done what we've done. I don't think you can do it. It's remarkable. Most of us still like each other. That's kind of part of the craziest miracle in AA. We always talk about miracles in AA. I have a friend over in Indianapolis that he says he thinks he sees the biggest miracle in AA every time he goes to a closed discussion meeting, and you'll have 25 or 30 alcoholics sitting there and wait their turn to talk. First step's been on my mind a lot here recently. Kind of getting out of track here. There's a friend of some of the guys from Cincinnati in here that was over attending my home group. My home group, incidentally, is the Dignitary Sympathy Group. That's right. There are no dignitaries there. Sure as hell isn't any sympathy there either, no. One of the guys from Cincinnati came over and started attending our group for a while, and he was 7 years sober, I think. Does that sound right? And he was really questioning his first step, and he really wanted to drink. He really wanted to drink. And he came up to me one night afterward, and he referred to the test in the big book. You know, the one where Bill suggests that they go back out and drink, try to drink and stop again. He said, Gary, do you think that test is legitimate? And I says, anything in the big book's legitimate. There's nothing in there that's not legitimate. I certainly do. And he says, well, how do you think I should do it if I'm going to do it? And I said, well, try to drink the one drink a day for 30 days. Take any more, you screwed it up. If take any less, you screwed it up. Well, he dropped out of sight. Didn't hear from him for several weeks. He called me one day, and I said, well, how's it going? He said, well, I've lost my girlfriend. I've lost two of my three restaurants. They haven't found the car yet. I got to move in with my folks. I don't have any money left. His folks are elderly, and they don't have any money. And I says, well, you know, man, I've been around AA for a long time, and I've only seen one person that had as much time in the program as you have go back out and try the test and pass it. And he said, Gary, all I wanted was a D. Just last weekend, a fellow, a friend of Mike's and mine, 10 years sobriety, decided that he knew he could do it now, and so he went out and he took a drink. 10 years sober, ex-Vietnam vet, done the route, done tons of work in the program. He seemed to be start replacing some things in with other things in AA, but he went out and drank last Saturday. and I don't remember the precise time, but in less than 3 hours, he went from a man with 10 years of sobriety to being chained to a hospital bed at our general hospital there in Indianapolis. I mean, that's progression. That's quick. He, incidentally, was instrumental in getting a few guys back to meetings last week. A bunch of guys were at the meeting on Tuesday that had been kind of skipping meetings, and they had a whole new resolve about coming around. I wrote an inventory quickly. I took it with another guy in AA I didn't particularly like, but then again, I didn't particularly like anybody. And I got through my first fifth step with him, and I got on, and I went on through the steps as best I did. I don't know that it wasn't the best I could. And we had found a process there in the group. We had found a process that this thing worked so well. We got so much relief, or at least I did. I shouldn't be speaking for anybody. I got so much relief from that first time going through the steps. Alcoholic thinking set in for me, and it might have saved my life. If it works that good once, I wonder what will happen if I do it again. And so, without ever having made the decision, I ended up being committed to a life of repeatedly going through the 12 steps in order and repeatedly taking other people through them in order. And that's been my life pretty much ever since I've came into AA. It was this business of helping people get through the big book and the steps. Now, I got confused for a short time early in my sobriety where I'm just trying to think everything we got involved in. I got to reading the Hazelden Guide, 12 and 12, the Little Red Book. You see, then I had all these things, and so then you can design your own program. I don't know how many of us out here have our own personally designed AA program. But when it comes tumbling down, and invariably they do, it's painful as hell. Oh, I forgot, we were going to the tongue-talking prayer groups, too, and we were doing that. That was exciting. God, the pain of all that was incredible. And I got back into AA again, and got back into going through the 12 steps again. Things were kind of cruising along, and a series of circumstances, we ended up moving to Indiana back in 1977. I had been in business with a lady who had had cancer, and when she returned to the business after struggling with the disease, I hadn't done anything right, and we couldn't get along, and I wasn't honest enough to really face up to her. And so I gave her my half of the business. I think I hoped it had shut her up. I don't think it did. And moved to Indiana. And you see, what I want to share with you is I would always get so far in the steps. I would get up through the fifth step and do six and seven, and maybe I'd write my amends list, but then I'd quit. I wouldn't go any farther. I always pulled my punch at that point. And so here I am, I'm talking at conventions, and I'm going to AA meetings, and I'm helping other people through the steps, but I'm disappearing when it comes right down to the crunch. And about 10 years ago now, I was in serious trouble. And my marriage was in serious trouble. I couldn't make a living. I couldn't do anything. And I called a man in Chicago who I've always had a great deal of respect for as a person in AA. This guy today now has 46 years, 47, something like that. And I've known him for many, many years. And I called him, and my telephone call went something like this. I said, do you suppose a 45-year-old alcoholic with 20 years of sobriety can be going through male menopause? And he says, well, maybe. But if you go through the steps, take another, write another fourth step, come up here, take some fifth step, and make some amends, you're probably going to feel better. And I agreed to that. And I wrote an inventory again. Interesting nuts, I wasn't covering any old ground. Most of the resentment lists were uninventoried items. Most of the fear list was uninventoried items prior to that. And the sex inventory went back through my entire life. And I called him and I told him I was finished. And he said, good. He says, be up here Friday. Told me where a motel was out in LaGrange, out on Ogden Street. He says, why don't you be here by 4 o'clock? And so I said, okay. And I got there at 3:45, went and got a cup of coffee and got to my room. And knock on the door, and it's some monkey I'd never seen before. He looks at me, he says, my name's Dennis O'Brien. I'm an alcoholic. I'm 29 years sober. And I'm here to exchange fifth steps with you. I'll go first so you know what to do. And this monkey comes in, sits down, opens up a 3-ring binder, and starts taking a fifth step with me. Hey, much like my inventory, incidentally. The names are different. Times weren't quite the same. So I did mine, and we exchanged notes on what the other guy had missed. And Dennis leaves, and a few minutes later, I knock on the door, and some guy says, my name's Chuck, I'm 21 years sober, and I'm here to swap fifth steps with you. I'll go first, so you know what to do. The same thing. By noon Sunday, I've done it 9 times. With people in sobriety at that point in time from 36 years down to 2 or 3. And I had a number of people that knew me real well, and I had talked about some of those things that I had hoped to take to the grave without talking to at least 9 times. Did you know the more that you talk about some of these slimy little things, the weller you get? Yeah. Met some of them for lunch that Sunday. We took steps 6 and 7 in the restaurant, holding hands with people looking. Doesn't bother me near as much now. And they said, let's help you with your amends list. They had remarkable memories. I was thumbing through my big book up in the room right just before I came in here, and I still carry it with me. And all the lines are drawn through. They're crossed off. All those I've had. I've had to make a couple cents for some later foolishness. I left there again in my life, I knew I had something going. I had some momentum. I had some impetus there. And I have always known, you need to understand, I have always known that the answer to this thing is in the 12 steps as it's laid out in the big book. I don't believe anything else is the answer other than that today. But I screwed with it to find out. I had to learn it the hard way. So anyway, I went home and I sat down with Julie and we discussed this. Julie and I have been together all our lives, and she was with me through a lot of this, and she saw a lot of these amends as hers. And so we really committed to some way to somehow we were going to take care of all of these amends. And we owed thousands and thousands of dollars. We didn't owe it for anything. It isn't like there were new cows and couches and cars and stuff around there. We just owed it. And so we had it all laid out how to take care of it. And we started the process of calling people, and we really intended to get it going. We really tried it. In fact, I got, this was on a Tuesday that we decided to start this. And so we called the immediate people we could take care of that night to take care of a couple of these things. We had taken money from both our parents under a great, we had all the reasons in the world for needing the money and seriously signed notes to repay the money. Of course, never did. We just owed all of this. And so I called her folks. And Julie's dad answered the phone, the same guy that wanted to get me out of town. And I called him and I told him, I said, Ellis, I really owe you an amend, and I owe you an amend for a lot of things. And I'm calling to make arrangements to get all this money paid back to you. But I owe you an amend for the pain I put you through. Because I know I put you through so much pain with the way I treated your daughter and your granddaughters. And you've been so patient and tolerant with me. I am truly grateful for it. And whatever I can do to set that right, I'll be happy to do it. And I really love you. And Ellis says, well, shit, here's Grandma. And he hands her the phone. And so I go through the same thing with Julie's mom. And we get down to that. And I said, by the way, do you have any idea how much money you've given us over the years? And she says, right down to the last penny. So I make arrangements to start making payments for that. Called a man in Laramie that I had worked for while I was going to college. He trusted me and he hired me to watch his store when he was absent. And I left Laramie probably the best dressed graduating senior to ever graduate the University of Vermont. And I'd stolen just damn near every bit of those clothes. I'd never paid him for them. And so I called him up. Keep in mind, I was sober when I was in Laramie. I called him up and I said, this is Gary Brown. Do you remember me? He says, yeah. He said, you used to work for me. He said, do you still go to those meetings? And I said, yeah, that's why I'm calling. And so I told him how much I'd taken and how much I thought I owed him. And there's dead silence on the other end of that phone. And finally he says, you know, I thought you were stealing that shit. But we set up a payment plan, and I was good on it for about 3 months, and then I didn't get a commission check. Missed the payment, and he called me and done me. And then at the same time, he says, nah, Gary, he says, I'm so glad about what you're doing. He says, don't worry about mine. He says, I don't want that money. And he forgave me the debt. And, there were many of them. Sometime later, about 5 years later, Julie and I look at this deal, and we're not making any headway. I mean, that list hasn't gotten anywhere. Nothing's happened. And I got this monkey in Chicago calling me 2-3 times a month saying, how you doing on the amends? Well, hell, I was forced to lie to him sometimes. It was so bad. No. We're talking about it. We're not getting anywhere. Nothing's getting any better. We know our lives will get better if we can get through this. If we can find a way to do that, we know it. She knew it better than I knew it, I think. But she says to me this night, you know, we've lived in this nice house here on the southeast side of Indianapolis for 11 years. We could probably sell a house, cash in your retirement stuff, your 401ks and all that, and there might be enough to take care of all those old men's. Maybe some of the current debt, and there might be enough we can find a used mobile home to live in or something. And I said, yeah, sure. I mean, that's heavy stuff. Think about that. I really hoped she wasn't serious. And when I came home from work that next evening, I knew she was serious, and I said, well, let me call Paul and see what he says about it. And so I called him, and I said, well, you've known me for a long time, and you've always been quick to tell me when I'm local, try this on. And so I told him that we're thinking about selling the house and doing all that. And he says, damn, he says, that's the sanest thing I've heard you say in 20 years. Are you sure it was your idea? And I said, it's Julie's, and he said he thought so. Want you to know you got trouble you can't imagine when your wife, or your sponsor is your wife's biggest fan. I mean, it's a serious problem. So that was in September when I made the phone call. On the 28th of February, the next year, the house sold, and we had the greatest day of our lives. We got to track down all those people that I owed that money to. In fact, I called John over in Laramie, and all I said to him was, I need your address. I'm in shape to pay you that money. And he gave me the address. He forgot he forgave me. Some years before that, I mean, we took care of all of them, and we did get in a mobile home, but there was a thing that happened in there that you need to know about. Sometime before I made the first call to Paul, a good friend of mine that does what we're doing here and that called me and said he had some extra time. And we hadn't seen each other for a long time. And he was talking at a conference someplace, I think down in Virginia. And he says, I think I'd like to leave home here and fly down and spend Thursday and Thursday night with you and Julie, and then I'll fly on to wherever the hell he's talking and take care of that. And so he did. I was delighted to see him. We meet at the airport and we go get a cup of coffee, and he looks me in the eye and he says, you look terrible. Again, that's not an exact quotation. He said, what's going on? And I said, well, they're going to foreclose on our house in the morning. Now, that's bad enough, but the bad part is Julie doesn't know that. I haven't told anybody. None of my friends in AA know about that. And they're going to foreclose it, and I'm terrified, and I'm so concerned about what Julie's going to do, and just scared to death. And he's the first time I'd ever told anybody that. I mean, I just got relief telling him that. And so anyway, we're driving out to the house in the airport. We're going out I-70. And he says to me, where's the bank? What bank? The one that has a note on your house. Well, it's right downtown over here, First Indiana. And he said, let's go see them. He says, let's go see if they'll talk. And I said, they're all done talking. What they don't want is talk. They ain't talking. And so he says, no, let's go do it. And so I'd never been able to say no. And I went down there and we parked. And to this day, I'll never forget walking into that bank with him. I'm never going to. Have any of you guys ever had to walk in to see the principal with your dad? Huh? And we went in there and we sit down. And he says to the man, he says, what's it take to get him even? I mean, he wasn't there to talk. He wasn't there to negotiate. And the guy gave him the number, and my friend was carrying it in cash and traveler's check, and he got me even right there. So you think I felt foolish going in? You should have been in my skin going out. And I'll never forget. I said to him, I got to pay back somehow. I don't know how I'm ever going to get it done. And he said, that's your problem. And so I got to call him on this February 28th and get his address and told him the check was on the way. And he laughed. I'm sorry. He laughed. And I said, what's so funny? He says, well, when I was doing that and gave you that money, he says, we had a great deal of money. We were making an awful lot of money. And my wife and I had decided to tithe this way and to help people out when we could. And that was our tithe. And so, you know, smart guy, you weren't the only one I was able to help out. I helped out a number of people around the country that way. And he says, my business has changed. He says, it's not as lucrative as it once was. As a matter of fact, I'm in serious trouble. And I'm talking to lawyers, and money's scarce, and it's just crazy. And he says, I really haven't talked to anybody. I haven't called in any bets or anything like that. And checks just show up in the mail. They're just coming around. So he gave me that gift of being able to watch this thing that goes around in AA to come back around. And it worked. And it worked just fine. I want you to know that as a result of having done the steps in order, and I've done more work in them since. That's not the last time I took an inventory, and God forbid it be the last. I've taken the steps in order many, many times. And the more I do it, the more I'm convinced that's the way to do it. That it works. And there's no reason to get fancy. The big book spells it out just right. It really does. Julie and I are free. We got a nice little old used mobile home. It's not as near as bad. I like to make that real dramatic when I tell that, but it's a nice place to live. When I talked here a couple of years ago, I said, you ever had to winterize a mobile home? Tony goes, click, you plug them in, dude. That's it. That's you're done. That's great. It's worked very well. I can go back to Cheyenne. I can go anywhere I've been. I can go to any AA meeting in the United States, and I don't have to hope somebody's not there because I want money. If I'm walking down the street and see somebody I burned, I don't have to slip in a doorway or down an alley. I can look them in the eye. I used to brag in AA when we talked about the promises on pages 83 and 84. The way I used to say it was, I've experienced each and every one of those problems at one time or another. Now that's kind of cute, you gotta listen. But for the most part, since we've gotten through the steps and we've done all that, I've experienced every single one of those promises at the same time. And it's worked. I'm amazed every time I get to talk in an AA meeting, because I can look out at the crowd and it strikes me that whatever the number of us is that's been here, we came here because we know there's some value here. We've found some value. But the strength of us is so much greater than the number of us. It just blows me away. And that's the only reason I'm able to stand here and be free and look at you people out there, either getting free or you are free. And that's great. If you ever have any doubts about this program, forget it. It works. It really does. Thank you for having me.